There was just one thing that bothered me. Why were so many houses on Juniper Street for sale? Hey folks, let's get the answer to that and other pressing questions here on the Mystery Hour on Sunsounds of Arizona. Hey, thank you so much for tuning in. Keith Tyler saying, I sure appreciate it. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Lone Thiels in their Passport to Crime section writes our first story, and it's called The Murders on Juniper Street. The realtor spent half an hour showing me through the house. A young rascal, barely 25, he used all his profession's platitudes. Family-friendly, Airbnb-ready, and the like. When he played the a stone's throw from the beach card, it took all my willpower not to ask why anyone would want to throw a stone from the house to the beach. But I am a polite woman. 65 years of age, the sort who goes to gallery openings and classical church concerts, so I merely sent him a sour look, which of course he didn't see, as he was busy arranging his next appointment on his phone. So, what do you say, Frau Havlev? Wouldn't this place be perfect for you? Haverslev, I said automatically. Not that I thought the correction would stick in his memory for even 3 seconds. The man was a walking Snapchat. Whatever I said was gone in an instant. I had provided the basic information. I was single, a writer, had spent time in the area as a child, and knew quite well where the beach was. Perhaps it was too much to imagine that he might deduce from what I had told him that I didn't need family-friendly facilities, that I knew it would take a catapult to launch a stone from Juniper Road to the beach. Well, I'd like to think about it, I said. Real estate agents hate that sentence. Well, there are other people looking at the house, he complained. I'd like to walk around the garden a bit. Michael, as he had introduced himself, spread his arms in an invitation. Alone? I clarified. Ah, okay, he said, and at last he drove off and left me there alone. The house, it suited me just fine. It had a wood-burning stove, a living room where I could sit in peace, a conservatory where I could spread out the drafts of my work in progress. It had been built in the mid-70s, but the previous owner had repainted the orange and brown woodwork with an inoffensive crackled white. There was nothing wrong with the place. In fact, it was just what I was looking for. I strolled around back to the garden and found roses and blackberries, old birch trees mixed with new trees that the previous owner had planted with care. A walnut tree, apple trees, elders. There was just one thing that bothered me. Why were so many houses on Juniper Street for sale? As I'd come down the road in my little Ford Ka, I'd counted no fewer than 7 of them with for sale signs planted beside their driveways. On one of the signs, ivy had climbed high enough to partially conceal the realtor's name and phone number. I'd asked Snapchat Michael, of course, and he'd mumbled something about the recession and municipal planning, but that answer didn't make sense. There were no for sale signs on Forest Way and only one on Spruce Road, so why had Juniper Street been hit so hard? As I inspected the compost pile and a bed of sunchokes in the far corner of the garden, I noticed a handsome older gentleman in a dark blue fleece jacket next door, methodically raking leaves and dumping them into a wheelbarrow. He nodded when he saw me. Have you bought number 5? Well, I'm thinking about it, I acknowledged. It'll be good to have some company out here. Why are there so many homes for sale on this road? He shrugged and offered the same explanation I'd gotten from Michael. The municipality had bought the land around Flodden and zoned it for summer cottages. A small move that ought to have been a windfall for the municipal coffers, not least because there had for years been a demand for summer homes in the area, close to the forest and beach, and within easy driving distance of both Randers and Aarhus. Yes, the project was a sure winner, until the financial crisis hit. I wrinkled my nose. Yeah, I understand all that, but why Juniper Road in particular? My potential neighbor tipped his wheelbarrow load of leaves onto a pile and looked directly at me. Would you like a cup of coffee? I nodded and followed him to a tiled terrace that was sheltered from the road by a couple of dwarf pines. He left me to sit in the sun at a slightly peeling dark green table and went into his kitchen, came back a little later bearing a tray with two cups that clinked lightly against their saucers and two French waffles on a plate. The waffles were a little lowbrow for my taste, but the man was rather handsome, which made up for it. Intense blue eyes, freshly shaven, a touch of gray in his still thick hair. I guessed he was about my age, perhaps a couple of years older. My name is Esben Boysen, he said. Retired pharmacist. Milk or sugar?
Milk, please.
He went back inside and came out with a small white cow creamer. I started to introduce myself, but he stopped me. No, I know who you are. My wife devoured your novels with great pleasure.
She doesn't anymore?
I asked, my voice anxious. You're never better than your last book, and though I've written 14 of them and have an audience in Norway and Estonia as well as Denmark, uncertainty is something you only put aside at rare moments. Perhaps his wife had grown tired of Kurt Ennevold, my private detective. The retired pharmacist shook his head. No. She died 3 months ago.
Oh, I'm sorry. Was she ill? I write about death every day, but I never quite know how to deal with it in reality.
He shook his head. It was quite sudden.
Oh, traffic accident?
He poured coffee, first for me, then for himself. He helped himself to a French waffle and carefully bit off one corner.
Poison, actually.
Poison? Yes, a fatal accident.
What happened?
He looked at me. Do you have some time?
Oh, yes, of course.
Espen Boysen leaned back in his rickety garden chair and began to tell me the story. Berit Hansen was the first to die. It was well known that she was a bit of a garden thief, and she expired practically in the middle of one of her raids.
Oh, go on.
Well, she had the most beautiful front yard on Juniper Street, perhaps in all of Fjellerup. I don't know if you came down Hill Road on your way here, but maybe you noticed a brown house with lots of flowers out front? He didn't wait for an answer. Her garden was always full of interesting flora, yet you never saw her at the nursery. She bought her plants with a trowel rather than with a credit card. He paused to nibble again at his waffle, then went on. Ellen Bach, she's a veterinarian, lived across Juniper Street from the house you're considering buying. She had a beautiful bed of lilies of the valley that blossomed across her yard like shimmering snowflakes every spring. It was so beautiful. One weekend, she and her husband came up from
Aarhus to find a big black square right in the middle of the bed, like a little grave. She asked the neighbors if they'd seen anything, but no one had. Not even Barrett, who, funnily enough, had a lovely new bed of lilies of the valley on one side of her terrace. "Ah," I said, pouring coffee for my host, and then myself. Of course, there wasn't enough evidence to make a direct accusation against Barrett, but several of us began to notice, what should I call it? A pattern? He took a sip of coffee and continued. Christine Berg at number 15 came home unexpectedly from a trip to Grenya and found Barrett in her backyard hunched over her blueberry bushes with her trowel in her hand. Barrett explained that she'd been weeding in her own garden when she saw a dog running loose in Christine's yard and had come to chase it away. Did Christine buy that story? Well, no, not really. Everyone knew that Barrett stole from their gardens when they weren't at home. It was completely obvious, but it's hard to prove a thing like that, and of course we tried to maintain good relations with our neighbors. It would be uncomfortable to bump into her at the waffle bakery once an accusation had been made. So, what happened? Most of us suffered in silence. I think Mads Brun, at number 11, got fed up when she made off with most of his tulips. He waited until she went home to Hadsten for the weekend, and then he simply took them back. All but one, which he left behind like an accusing middle finger. Did Barrett stop stealing after that? Oh, no. She acted as if nothing had happened. Did she take anything from you? Esben nodded. She did. Lottie and I bought some very special bulbs in Holland, a type of dark purple tulip we'd never seen in Denmark. But they never really took hold, or at least so we thought, until we saw a cluster of 7 or 8 of them. Yep, down at Barrett's. Did you confront her? He shook his head. Oh, I wanted to, but Loretta convinced me to let it go in the name of good neighborliness. But then the pirate was caught red-handed. Christine lived across the street from Barrett. She'd dug up an old tree stump, put it beside her front door, and decorated it with those little salad greens. You know what I mean. They grow almost anywhere. You mean ramsons? Ah, yes, that's it. Well, they must have been too tempting for Barrett, and Christine's husband, Fleming, found Barrett one Sunday morning slumped against her porch steps. He took another sip of coffee. Dead. She was stealing the ramsons? Esben shrugged. She'd skipped the tree stump, like a child picking sprinkles off of a cake, when the grown-ups weren't looking. She had a plastic bag of leaves in her hand. It must have been scary to find her. Fleming's a retired teacher, so he takes everything in stride. He checked for a pulse, then went into the house and called 112. An ambulance came from Randers and took her away. The neighbors must have been shaken up, I said. Oh, yes, of course. We don't drop dead every day around here. But that wasn't the end of it. A little after noon, I heard a terrifying scream from my neighbor, Malene Falk Poulsen. He was a good storyteller, and I felt a shiver run up my spine. Why did she scream? But, like a good pharmacist, Esben Boysen doled out his tale in precisely measured doses to achieve the maximum effect. It's probably best if I tell you a little bit about Malene's husband, Mogens Falk Poulsen, first. He was a lawyer and a chairman of our homeowners association, where he believed his role was to keep tourists away from Fjellrup and to annoy the rest of us in that arrogant way some lawyers can't seem to avoid. I'm sure you know the attitude. "He doesn't sound particularly pleasant," I said, taking a bite of my waffle. The white cream between the two pieces of flaky dough tasted synthetic, left a greasy film in my mouth. "Nope. He invested a lot of energy in fighting progress, didn't understand that this area might be of some value to others than just a summer homeowners. The minute the municipality proposed adding more parking spaces down by the beach or public toilets near the campground, well, they were hit with a veritable swarm of letters from the High Court attorney, Falk Poulsen, as he liked to call himself. I think they must be a whole filing cabinet full of furious missives from his office about how the municipality was trying to degrade the beauty of the area. Did he get anywhere with all that effort? The retired pharmacist shook his head. Eh. So he took his anger out on us. I once got a good slap in the face in front of the HOA when I pointed out that no public toilets on the beach might have a negative impact on our property value. Bloody pill pusher, he called me. He sounds a lot like my sister's ex-husband, I remarked. Well, I haven't met your sister's ex-husband, but Falk Poulsen was, to say the least, a conceited fool. Esmond finished his waffle and went back into the house. A little later, he came out with a bowl of King of Denmark candies. Oh, my favorites. I popped one into my mouth and savored its mild aniseed flavor. When he resumed his seat, I said, "You were telling me about Falk Poulsen." "Ah, yes. He had very few friends here, but he hardly had time for friendships because he was obsessed with his lawn. It was his pride and joy. He cut it with a riding mower every weekend during the season, kept it looking like a putting green. If one of us dared to let our dog so much as set a paw on his grass, we'd be threatened with hell damnation and a lawsuit. Not necessarily in that order. And that Saturday morning, you heard Maylene scream? What had happened? I was saying goodbye to the nice couple from Stuttgart who rented the big white house up the road. They wanted tips on places to forage as they drove home, and I lived in the Hamburg for a while, so unlike most people in the area, I speak fluent German. But then Maylene screamed, I said, hoping to get him back on track. Yes. At first, I actually thought Mogens must have hit her. I mean, he was the type who would. So, of course, I ran over there. And had he hit her? No. What I saw that afternoon, I will never forget. I think he must have lost consciousness while riding the mower and run it into the big birch tree in the middle of his yard. It was idling there, chewing deep ruts in the grass. Maylene had heard the roaring of the motor and come running outside, and when she saw what had happened, she screamed. What did you do? Well, I turned off the mower. It was one of those gigantic yellow Stiga Rider Park Pro models. Mogens had collapsed, and his head was hanging in an unnatural way. I've seen a lot of dead bodies in my time as a pharmacist, and the moment I got close, yeah, I could tell. He was a goner. How could you be sure? His eyes, yeah, they were half open, and he wasn't breathing, didn't have a pulse. Maylene stood there weeping, and for her sake I tried mouth to mouth, but it was hopeless. They had to send another ambulance from Randers. They had a doctor with them, and he pronounced the poor bastard dead on the spot. Two on the same day, I said. That can't have been a coincidence. Esmond Boysen held up a hand as if to interrupt me. Three, he reminded me. 3 with my wife. I bowed my head slightly. Yeah, yes, of course. My condolences. He sighed. I stood there with Marlene. We fetched a blanket from the living room and covered him while we waited for the ambulance. It took forever for them to arrive. She was completely inconsolable, and I was a little irritated with Lottie, who had curled up with a crime novel, one of yours, actually, in a hammock in our yard and hadn't stirred through all the commotion. I could hardly leave Marlene, but when Elvira Fugelsang from Heather Lane came by with her Cocker Spaniel, I asked her to bring my wife to take over. Women are always better when it comes to comforting and whatnot. He narrowed his eyes and looked out over his garden. Then he pointed toward the largest pine tree and the cluster of them at the far end of the yard. That's where she was lying. It was a little after lunch, and I'd been out front weeding. She was tired, she said. I thought it was because of the party. Oh, what party? He shook his head. We had a block party the night before. You got home late? Well, no, not especially. I just thought she didn't want to help with the weeding. Lottie was never particularly fond of gardening. That was always my department. And she didn't react to the commotion when you found Mogensfalk Poulsen. She did not. As we neared the subject of his wife's death, I could see that it was becoming harder for him to talk. We sat in silence for a while, and I watched a squirrel, one of those little red ones, jump from branch to branch. Through the pharmacist's hedge, I could make out the black A-frame I was considering buying. It looked cozy even from a distance, and I imagined how it would appear with a fire in the wood-burning stove and candles in the windows. Elvira returned in 2 minutes. She was completely ashen. She couldn't wake Lottie. I leaned forward in my chair. So what did you do? Well, I raced home fast as I could. And there she was, my wife of 34 years, in her worn-out garden shorts and batik shirt. Her mouth was half open, and your book had fallen to the grass. It was the one with the big red house on the cover. Summer, I replied automatically, immediately cursing myself for interrupting him. Esben nodded, not taking much notice. It was while I was trying to rouse her that the ambulance arrived, so I ran out to the road to get the EMTs. At first, there was confusion. They thought they'd been given the wrong address, couldn't understand that 2 people had collapsed almost simultaneously in 2 houses on opposite sides of the street. Our coffee was getting cold. I took a sip and grimaced. Yeah, that would have been hard to imagine, I said. Indeed, said the pharmacist. The police also found it strange, so they came to investigate, and not just a patrolman, but an actual detective. He concluded that they must have eaten something toxic. All 3 of them? At the same time? How could that have been possible? He shrugged. Yes, of course, that was the question. By then, panic was spreading. The first thought was that perhaps they'd gotten bad fish from the fishmonger. Yes. It was absurd to think that those 3 people should have concocted a suicide pact. They had nothing in common except that they each had a summer house on the same road. There must have been more than that, I objected. Well, yes. They'd all been to the block party the night before. It was Ellen Bach and her husband who held it. For some reason, the vet thought we should all be friends. I have no idea why. But every year, for her birthday, she and Torkild lit up the grill and invited the residents of Juniper Street to a party. Most of us showed up, some because we enjoyed it, others for the free wine and beer, others only for the gossip.
And you were there with Lottie?
Yeah, all of us who were here that weekend came, even Imka and Udo, though it was mostly me who spoke to them. Ellen and Torkild provided the wine and beer, and we all brought our own meat for the grill, or salad, whatever we could afford.
And the police thought that the poisoning must have happened there, at the party?
Esben shrugged. It had been a hot August day, and now that the sun had disappeared behind the tall treetops, the afternoon had grown cooler.
Do you want to come down and watch the sunset? He asked. It's quite spectacular.
I agreed, not bothering to tell him that I knew the area well.
We walked up the small hill where number 5 was, turned down Heather Lane past Buin, and came out onto a small flat beach. In the distance you could make out the windmills in the golden light. I wriggled out of my sandals and let my feet sink into the sugary white sand. It was exactly as I'd remembered it from my childhood beach trips with Uncle Cadge and Aunt Elsa. The vast horizon and fresh air seemed to bring Esben alive, and I thought it had done him good to talk about what had happened. Perhaps this was the first time he had ever discussed the circumstances of his wife's death.
Did the police ever figure out how it happened?
He shook his head. By the time they began their investigation, Thorkill had cleaned his grill, and all the plates and bowls people had eaten from had been washed and put away. No one could really remember who had eaten what and when, or whether Lottie Barrett or Morgans Falk Poulsen had eaten or drunk the same thing.
So the matter was never resolved?
That's right. The only thing Detective Nielsen ever established for certain was that the Lily of the Valley leaves had come from Ellen Bach's own front garden. But no one knew who had taken them or how they'd ended up being eaten by the three victims.
We walked a little further.
"Do you miss her?" I asked.
"Who, Lottie?"
He veered away from the shore and sat on a wooden bench that was positioned to face the setting sun.
"Actually, no. To be honest, we no longer had much in common. It's strange that she's not here, but we would have wound up apart in any case. She found someone else, and we were, headed for a divorce."
I sank down beside him on the bench. We sat in silence for a while, the sky fading from pastel pink to a dark orange.
"Esben, what's your own theory?
How did these three of them come to eat those poisonous leaves?"
He took several deep breaths as if he were about to speak, but then at the last moment lost his courage.
"You know, I have a theory," I said, fishing.
"Udo and Imka," he said at last.
"The Germans?"
"Yeah. They love the new Nordic cuisine. He talked a lot about it. They'd been to Noma before they went to the East Jutland. They bought a cookbook and had started foraging.
I remember they brought a salad that evening. Maybe they mistook Lily of the Valley leaves for Ramsons. It wouldn't be the first time that's happened.
And now they're back in Stuttgart, not knowing they're responsible for the deaths of three people."
Esben nodded.
"Have you told the police about this?"
He looked up at the sky, deep in thought.
"What good would it do? The dead are dead, and that's not going to change."
I shrugged. "Well, the victims' families might want to know the truth. Have you thought about that? So that they can move on. The police would understand if it was an accident. Don't you think?"
My question hung unanswered between us until Esben swatted a mosquito and got up from the bench.
"Anyway," he said,
Now you know why all those houses on Juniper Street are up for sale. Too many bad memories, too much gossip, too much suspicion aimed at too many directions. A lot of the owners just wanted to leave it all behind. We took Ocean Road back to the house for a change of scenery. It smelled of spruce, barbecues, and hot dust. In one front yard, two children batted a ball back and forth as we passed. "Espen," I said after a while, "there's something I've been thinking about." "Yes?" "Those three people had more in common than just the street they lived on during the summer months, didn't they?" He turned away from me, let his gaze wander out to the horizon, where the sun slipped slowly into the Kattegat embrace. "They were people you couldn't stand, weren't they?" He nodded weakly but said nothing. "There's something else I can't quite get my head around. Germans are sticklers for following the rules. I just can't see Udo and Imke sneaking into the veterinarian's front yard and helping themselves to what they thought were Ramsons without permission." Espen cleared his throat. "It's possible," he said quietly, "that someone might have suggested to them that Ellen Bach allowed her neighbors to pick Ramsons from her yard, isn't it?" "What are Ramsons called in German?" "Barlach," he said, a little too quickly. I squinted at him, but he was looking at the ground. "And why were only three of them poisoned?" "I remember Imke bringing that Ramsom salad in a big green bowl. I was the one who passed it around, but unfortunately I tripped over a tree stump at one point and spilled it all over the lawn." "Right after you served the three people who later died?" Espen shook his head. "No, not Barrett. She was so greedy she served herself before I even took the bowl from Imke." We had turned into Juniper Street. The white for sale sign glinted in the twilight. I stopped at number 5. Espen Boysen hesitated. "It's not certain that it happened like that," he said. "It's just a theory." "No, of course," I said, avoiding his gaze. Then he turned away and went back to his house. Just before he closed the door behind him, he raised his hand and waved. I stood there for a while beneath the big oak tree in the driveway. Oh, it was a beautiful house, and the price was right. I took my cell from my pocket and dialed Snapchat Michael. My call went straight to his voicemail. He was probably playing Candy Crush or scrolling through Tinder, so I left him a message. "This is Frau Haverslev, Michael. I'll take the house. I have a feeling I'm going to write some terrific crime stories here." All right, the author from that last story is from Denmark, and it was translated to English by Josh Pachter. Now I switch to another Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. This story is by Michael Bracken. It's called Blind Pig. Billy the Pick and I bought tickets to see a three-legged donkey at the Blind Pig, and our tickets came with complimentary mason jars filled with moonshine. The donkey was everything the handbill said it would be, a pissed-off tripod that tried to bite anyone who came close, and the complimentary moonshine was strong enough to melt your liver. So we purchased a second set of tickets, had a second looks at the aggravated ass, and downed some jars of moonshine. By the time we finished, the donkey had grown another head and three more legs. We retired to a dark alley half a block from the blind pig and helped each other remain upright. "You want to see it again?" Billy asked. He leaned against me and dug through his pockets looking for change. "I think we should go home," I said. But we didn't move. And that's where we were standing when a Ford pulled up to the curb in front of the blind pig with twins wielding Tommy guns and climbed out and walked inside. We sobered up fast when we heard men shouting, the donkey braying and a burp of the guns. We ran down the alley, away from the cacophony and parted company at the next street. I don't know where Billy went, but I ran all the way back to Miss Edna's rooming house and buried myself under the bed covers on my second floor room. The Midnight Massacre headlines the morning edition of the Times. I read the story over a cup of joe in Miss Edna's kitchen after I climbed out of bed much too late for breakfast. 15 men and a donkey, she said, when she saw what I was reading. Miss Edna's my mother's age, with gray hair pulled into a tight bun and wire-frame half-glasses perched at the end of her aquiline nose. Like always, she wore a white apron over her blue house dress. A three-legged one, I added. She stared at me. How would you know that, Mr. Robert? That poor donkey's disabilities are not mentioned anywhere in the article. I wasn't certain what I should say. You were there, weren't you? That's why you smell like you've been using grain alcohol as aftershave. I had slept in my clothes from the previous day and hadn't bathed since crawling out of the bed, but I didn't think I smelled that bad. Yeah, I said. Me and Billy the Pick were there. We had just left when all hell broke loose. That why you came running in here last night, like your tail was afire? You noticed. How could I not? If you'd made any more noise, you'd have woken Elmer. Elmer was the deaf man who let the room below mine. I opened my mouth to say something, but she cut me off. Well, it's a good thing you left when you did, she said as she held out her hand, else you wouldn't be able to pay this week's rent. I rifled my pockets and put everything I had on the table. My money clip was missing. Miss Edna counted the smattering of change. You're short. I'd had more than enough money for the rent before I'd stopped at the blind pig, and I didn't think I'd spent that much of it. I only had two drinks. I'm not interested in your excuses or your poor math skills, Mr. Robert. She scooped all the money from the tabletop into the pocket of her apron. Get the rest of the rent or finish your coffee and start packing. Billy had been digging deep in search for money for the third drink when the Ford pulled up in front of the blind pig, and during the commotion I hadn't paid any attention to where his hands were. My paucity of funds gave me a clue. End of the day, Miss Edna, I said. I'll have the rest of the rent before the end of the day. Humph, she snorted. Make sure that you do. I finished my coffee, bathed, and put on fresh clothing. Then I finished the last swallow of shine from the jar I kept in my bottom dresser drawer and went in search of my drinking companion. I had no idea where Billy rested his head, so I began my search with the places where we had bent elbows, hoping to find a fellow tippler who had seen him. Within an hour, I found him belly up to the bar at Booker's, a speakeasy hidden behind a wall and the Five and Dime.
Hey, hell of a thing that happened last night, Billy said when I settled into the bar stool next to him.
I suggested he lower his voice. I had no desire to encounter the Tommy Gunn twins, should they desire to eliminate witnesses.
"I'm not saying anything you can't read about in the newspaper," he said. And then he responded, "Hell of a thing."
Stumpy, the one-armed bartender, moved down the stick and glared at me with his good eye. "You gonna order a drink or just use up all the free oxygen?" I patted myself as if I expected to find spare change. Billy pulled a wad of cash from his pocket and tossed several dollar bills on the bar.
"An unopened bottle of the good stuff."
Stumpy made the money disappear as he put a bottle of untaxed Canadian whiskey in its place. He cracked the seal, splashed three fingers worth into each of the two tumblers, and pushed the tumblers and the bottle across the bar to us. Then he limped to the other end of the stick, where a floozy was chatting up a pot-bellied swell, wearing a bowler cocked at a jaunty angle. I had planned to ask Billy to return the money he had taken from my pocket less than a dozen hours earlier, but the moment he flashed the wad of cash, I had a different question. Once Stumpy was out of earshot, I lowered my voice and said, "You didn't have that last night, or we wouldn't have gone to the Blind Pig to see the three-legged donkey. Where'd you get it?" Billy leaned into me and lowered his voice.
"Those two guys weren't there to rob the place. They were there to send a message."
He downed his drink and poured himself another.
"I circled around, and after they drove off, I went in and back and took the money box."
"You went in there with all those dead guys?"
"Who do you think would try to stop me? The donkey?"
He brayed with laughter.
But nothing."
Billy pushed my untouched tumbler toward me, then lifted his own in a toast.
"Drink to me. This might be my last hurrah."
I stared at him for a moment before I lifted my tumbler and downed the whiskey in one smooth gulp. An hour later, the bottle was empty, Billy had gone to see a man about a horse, and I still didn't have money to pay my rent. Stumpy came for the bottle, but I wouldn't let him take the tumbler from my hand while it still contained a few drops of the good stuff. I motioned toward the bottle.
"You paying for it?"
I looked around.
"I don't think your friend's coming back. He went out the back half a bottle ago."
I swore, down the last few drops of untaxed Canadian whiskey, and staggered out through the hidden door into the five and dime. Billy and I had been drinking companions since the early days of Prohibition, but we'd never truly been friends. We had met when he was working the crowd outside the Paramount Theater, and I stood on the corner selling the late edition of the Times. I hadn't seen him lift the swell's wallet, but I did see him drop it into the gutter just before he was confronted by the wallet's owner. The broad-shouldered swell stood a head taller than Billy and held him by the lapels as he shouted accusations in Billy's face. I retrieved the wallet from the gutter and approached with it, saying in my outstretched hands, "Sir," I asked, "is this yours?" The swell released his grip on Billy and snatched the wallet from my hand.
"Where'd you get this?"
In the gutter over there, sir. You must have dropped it." When he glanced in the direction I was pointing, Billy slipped away. The swell opened the wallet and glared at me with a look that could have cracked walnuts.
"It's empty. My money's gone."
"I don't know a thing about that, sir," I told him. I offered him a copy of the late edition. "Paper, sir?"
"Bah!"
The swell smacked it aside and stalked away. I watched him go before returning my attention to hawking the newspapers remaining under my right arm. Later that night, after I sold my last paper and was walking home, Billy appeared at my elbow. Startling me, I asked, "You come to take my wallet too?" He laughed, slapped me on the shoulder, and opened his jacket to show me the whiskey bottle tucked into the inside pocket.
"Now something better." Billy and I had been companions ever since, and until the previous evening, he had never nicked anything of mine. As I saddled onto a park bench, I tried to clear the Canadian fog from my brain. I needed to find Billy again and not let my thirst and his generosity distract me from retrieving the money he'd taken. After several minutes spent sucking in fresh air, I headed to Polly's Pawn and Loan, a place where I regularly visited my father's nickel-plated .45, and where Billy and I often placed off-track bets on faraway horse races. Polly overflowed the chair he occupied behind the counter, and he waited until a young widow left the store sans wedding ring before he acknowledged my presence.
"Robert."
"Polly," I said, "you seen Billy the Pick?" The fat man used a yellow handkerchief to dab the sweat near his receding hairline.
"He was in this morning to pay off his gambling debt. He said he was going to Goldstein's after this to look at suits."
"Suits?" Billy never owned a suit in his life.
"Well, that's what he said. Maybe he was in the mood to window shop."
Polly dabbed at his forehead again. "What about you? Are you ready to pay?"
"Tomorrow," I said.
I would lose the 45 my father had carried during World War I if I didn't pay off that loan or at least pay that week's interest before the end of the business on tomorrow. "I'll have the money for you the next day."
"You betta," he said. "I got a guy keeps coming in to look at it."
Polly was dabbing again at the sweat off his forehead when I exited the pawn shop and walked 3 blocks south to Goldstein's. I pushed open the door of his haberdashery, and Hiram Goldstein himself looked up from the newspaper he was reading and greeted me from behind the counter. His welcome smile faded as I drew close enough for him to smell the Canadian whiskey oozing from my pores. With little enthusiasm, he asked,
"How may I assist you?"
"Billy the Pick. He been in here today?"
Goldstein appeared not to recognize the name. I didn't know Billy by any other name, so I described my drinking companion by holding my hand about a foot above the top of my head. About this tall, skinny as a rail, nose pointed left.
Goldstein brightened.
"Blue pinstripe and a belt, paid cash."
Sure, maybe. Where'd he go?"
"I'm afraid I don't know," Goldstein said. "He left with the belt, but we will have to take the trousers and the waist, so he'll be back tomorrow to pick up the suit."
I was about to turn away, but the headline in the Times afternoon edition caught my eye. Donkey Death Details. I spun the paper around so I could read about the previous night's massacre at the Blind Pig. Someone had provided the newspaper reporter with a detailed description of the Tommy Gunn twins and their thick bodies and broad shoulders and wide flat faces that looked like they'd been hit with frying pans. I knew of only 2 eyewitnesses who could have provided that information, and I hadn't said a word to anyone. After a few paragraphs of lurid details about the murder scene, the reporter quoted a police lieutenant who claimed the Chicago mob was moving into town and eliminating competition for their product. Small-time bootleggers were being pushed aside, and anyone caught selling a competitor's product was being eliminated. I caught the reporter, a man well known by police and by the people who frequent police stations, coming out of a speakeasy following his afternoon tea. "Hey, you talked to Billy the Pick about last night's killing, didn't you?"
"Well, now how would you know?"
Grover Duncan asked. Billy and I had occasionally been elbow to elbow with him when we were flush enough to afford the good stuff, so he knew us.
"Billy said he was all alone, Robert. Was he lying about that?"
I didn't answer Duncan's questions. "Billy's going to get himself killed. Those 2 guys are going to find out, and he was one that told you about them."
"I think he's already preparing for that eventuality," the reporter said. "I overheard him asking a cabbie to take him to a Rothman funeral home."
Irv Rothman met me in his funeral home foyer.
and I asked the somber-faced funeral director, why would Billy the Pick come here?
Excuse me, Billy the what?
I didn't know Billy's Christian name, so I described him.
Oh, Mr. Johnson, he said. William.
Yeah, sure, I suppose.
He prepaid for his funeral. He said he didn't want to wind up in a pauper's grave.
But why now? Rothman's steady, somber expression grew even more serious, and he placed a calming hand on my forearm as he gazed deep into my eyes.
Your friend hasn't told you.
Told me what?
Says he has cancer, that he hasn't much longer to live.
I felt my knees weaken, and Rothman's firm grip kept me upright.
He never said, not one word.
But I understood what Billy had meant by his last hurrah. Any ideas where Billy went?
After we talked, Rothman said, Mr. Johnson said something about a steak dinner, a good steak dinner, for his last meal.
There was only one place to get a decent steak, Delmonico's, and I wore out more shoe leather on my way there. I knew the hostess, a thick-bodied blonde who enjoyed a good tipple, and I asked her about Billy.
Yeah, he was here,
Sally said.
Had him a T-bone and a baked potato.
Well, that ain't cheap.
He was flashing money around like it grew on trees, and he owned an orchard. Gave little Ginny the biggest tip she'd ever received.
If I didn't find my drinking buddy soon, I would never get my rent money back, nor would I understand what he was doing. I've been looking for Billy all day, I told her, and I'm always one step behind.
You ain't the only one who's looking for him.
Surprise, I asked. How's that?
Two other guys was in here asking about him. They were that ugly sees when it looks in the mirror. They didn't know Billy's name, but said he'd been flashing money around, money he shouldn't have had.
They weren't wrong.
I didn't tell them nothing, but after they left, Mr. Delmonico told me the twins were new enforcers in the Chicago mob, and that they would be supplying the restaurant's hooch from now on or else.
Her eyes narrowed as she started staring at me.
You're shaking.
I was also sweating. Sally took my arm and we stepped into the coat room. She pulled a nearly empty bottle of Canadian from under the counter and handed it to me.
Take a nip and set yourself straight.
I took a swallow directly from the bottle and tried to hand it back.
Take it with you, she said. You need it more than I do.
She was right. On my way out the back, I drained the bottle and left the empty in the trash can. Then, knowing Billy did most of his drinking after sunset, I began visiting every gin joint and blind pig we'd ever visited together. I finally found him in the back booth at Skipper's, where I confronted him and told him I wanted my money he had taken from me the previous night.
I didn't take your money, Billy said. I don't know what happened to it, he insisted, but I didn't take it.
As I dropped into the booth opposite Billy, he motioned to the slender young waitress, tapped his glass, and held up two fingers. A moment later, she brought two tumblers of whiskey straight up.
I've never taken anything from anyone who meant anything to me, he lifted his glass. Here's to you.
I hesitated, licked my lips, and then lifted mine. We drank.
We're nobodies, you and me,
Billy said as he motioned for a refill.
Nobody looks at us twice. You know why? Because we don't have money. Well, that changed today. Everybody saw me today, and tomorrow they're going to see me as a shop-dressed man in a new suit.
People see you right now, Billy, I said. Those two guys, the ones you ratted out to the newspaper, well, they're looking for you. Sally over at Delmonico's said they were in and asking about you not long after you had dinner. She said she didn't tell them anything, but why'd you rat them out?
I did it for the donkey, Billy said. He didn't do nothing to nobody.
I stared across the table at him.
Besides, I got nothing to lose, Billy said. The doctor says I got the cancer and it's eating me up from the inside.
Refills arrived. I wanted to stay and drink with Billy, but I couldn't. I had to find my money clip. I pushed my refilled glass across the table without drinking, then returned to where things had started. the alley near the Blind Pig where we had listened while the Tommy Gun twins killed 15 men and a 3-legged donkey. I poked around in the dark and finally found my money clip caught behind the wheel of a trash bin. All my money was there, and I felt bad about accusing Billy of taking it. After stopping for a mason jar of shine to take back home, I returned to Miss Edna's rooming house to find her in the sitting room with her hand out. I counted out the rent, stumbled upstairs, and took a long swallow of the shine before dropping onto my bed. Pounding on my door woke me some time later. I opened it to find Miss Edna standing in the hall.
"Billy's out front asking for you. I didn't let him in 'cause he's drunk as a skunk."
I stepped into the washroom. At the end of the hall, splashed water on my face, and then headed downstairs. Before I could reach the front door, squealing tires and the burp of Tommy guns made me hesitate. Then I was out the door, Miss Edna in her tattered blue robe only a few steps behind me. I found Billy the Pick on the front walk, a bottle of Canadian shattered on the bricks beside him. He had more holes than cheap Swiss cheese, and I was surprised he was still alive. Billy coughed up blood, and I could barely hear him when he spoke.
"I got tired of drinking alone."
"Call the coppers," I shouted over my shoulder at Miss Edna. As she turned away, Billy rasped,
"They got me before the cancer could."
"But
I didn't say nothing about you," he said. "They think it was just me who saw them."
I tried, but I couldn't stop the bleeding. I didn't know what else to do.
"Take my belt."
"What?"
"Don't argue," he said. "Take it."
As Billy the Pick expelled his last breath, I unbuckled his belt and unthreaded it from his trousers, realizing as I did that it was a money belt and that it held more than enough to pay my rent for several weeks. I didn't use all of it for that, though. The next morning after I notified the funeral home about Billy's death and told Hiram Goldstein where to deliver Billy's new suit, I returned to Polly's Pawn and Loan, retrieved my father's nickel-plated .45 and bought a box of bullets. Billy said we were nobodies, but he was wrong. He was somebody to me. The Tommy Gun twins wouldn't see me coming. Nobody would.
Well, my friend, excuse me. Well, my friends, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler saying thanks very, very much for tuning in, and please join me again next time. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.